At the time Esther's story begins, Ahasuerus was only in the third year of his 21-year reign. He was a very powerful king. From Susa, his capital, he ruled the vast Persian Empire from India to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. There was no more powerful man on earth at that time than the Persian king Ahasuerus. A queen named Vashti. The second significant person in the story is his queen, Vashti, and we meet her only a few verses later. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Esther chapter 1, verse 9. Although we don't know a great deal about Queen Vashti, we do know that she was a strong-minded, independent-thinking woman who was not afraid to go against the wishes of her husband, the king. Ultimately, it is her strong-mindedness that begins the conflict in the story, but more about that later. A wicked officer named Haman. The third character is Haman, a wealthy and influential officer in the court of the king. In fact, he occupied the next to the highest position in the kingdom, thanks to the king's promotion. After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. Esther chapter 3, verse 1. We'll soon get well acquainted with Haman, the deceitful, conceited, anti-Semitic villain of the plot. The godly Jew named Mordecai. The fourth person of significance in this story is a man of God named Mordecai, a Jew living in Persia. Now there was a Jew in Susa the capital whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimeah, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. Esther chapter 2, verses 5 and 6. Many years before Esther's story begins, the Jews had a civil war, and the Jewish nation divided into the northern and southern kingdoms. The northern kingdom was called Israel in the scriptures. The southern kingdom was called Judah. Most of the kings in both kingdoms did not walk with God, at least not consistently. Eventually, God judged the people of the northern king because of their stubborn unfaithfulness and sent the armies of Assyria against them. As a result, the Jews of the northern kingdom, Israel, went into bondage. More than 100 years later, God brought similar judgment against the Jews in the southern kingdom because of their disobedience. Jeconiah was also known as Jehoiakim, the young king of Judah who reigned in 597 BC. He wore the crown only 3 months when Nebuchadnezzar invaded, deported him to Babylon, and removed the temple treasures. 11 years later, in 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar returned with a vicious blow, destroyed Jerusalem, and carried most of the Jews into captivity. Babylon itself fell into the hands of the Medo-Persians in 539 BC. Ahasuerus became king of the vast Persian Empire around 485 BC, about 100 years after the fall of Jerusalem. The book of Esther, then, is a slice of history from the life of the Jews living in exile in Persia. This remarkable story is proof that God did not forget them. Mordecai was a descendant of one of those exiled Jews. He was a godly man, and his most significant role was his relationship to the fifth and final character of our story. And he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Esther chapter 2, verse 7. A woman of inner and outer beauty named Esther. Esther, which is this young woman's Persian name, means star. This seems appropriate since she is truly the star of the show, the heroine of the story. The immortal, invisible, all-wise hand of God is working behind the scenes, hidden from human eyes. Only such a gracious and all-knowing being would have his hand on some forgotten orphan, a little girl who had lost her mother and father. Only such providence would be at work in the life of a lowly Jew living in exile in the great land of Persia, where Ahasuerus ruled in cruel sovereignty and self-serving Haman officiated in evil deceptions. There is a beautiful message here for anyone who has ever experienced brokenness, for anyone who has ever been crushed by life, for anyone who has ever felt that his past is so discolored, so disjointed, so fractured that there is no way in the world God can make reason and meaning out of it. We are going to learn some unforgettable lessons from Esther. Here was a little girl who must have cried her heart out at the death of her parents, bereft and orphaned, yet who years later would become key to the very survival of her people, the Jews. God, and God alone, can do such things. He, in fact, does do such things, working silently and invisibly behind the events of history. The plot of the story. Let me show you just a few examples as we look at a brief overview of the plot of this great story. First, let's look at something that sounds innocuous and insignificant, but which becomes, in God's unfathomable plan, the link to survival. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay king's hands on King Ahasuerus. Esther chapter 2, verse 21. Bigthan and Teresh. Even their names make them sound like a couple of thugs, don't they? Well, they are. They're the ones wearing the dark hats. They sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus is just another way of saying that they were putting together an assassination game plan. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on gallows, and it is written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. Esther chapter 2, verses 22 and 23. So, what's the big deal? What does this tidbit of history have to do with anything? Who cares about Bigthan and Teresh? Nobody. Only the scribe writing down the chronicles of history. So, for right now, let's put that little morsel of historical trivia on the back burner. Why? Because that seemingly insignificant fact is going to become vital in the plan of God. Again, why? Because, as we learned earlier, He is unfathomable and unsearchable, yet invincible, then as well as now. Next, let's glance at Haman. This guy hates Mordecai, not just because he's a Jew, but because Mordecai will not bow down to him. So Haman talks the king into a game plan. If you follow my rules, I will pour money into your treasury. All I ask is that you give me the right to rid the land of all these Jews. And so King Ahasuerus, believing Haman and ignoring the brutal genocide he is plotting, passes it off with a wave of his hand. Go ahead, do whatever you need to do. When Mordecai gets word of what Haman is planning, he makes a crucial but dangerous decision. He must tell his adopted daughter Esther. She must know about Haman's plan. Because, you see, by now, Esther had become queen, but nobody knew she was a Jew. When she was chosen as the king's consort, Mordecai had advised her not to tell anybody about her ethnic origins. Obediently, she didn't. Then Mordecai told Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?" Esther chapter 4, verses 13 and 14. Mordecai entertained no doubt that the Jews would survive this Holocaust. He was convinced that God would not let his people be wiped from the face of the earth. he and Esther might be killed, but ultimately someone would deliver the Jews. However, what if God's plan was already in process? What if the means to that deliverance had already been put in place by the hand of God? What if it included Esther's getting involved? "Esther, listen," says Mordecai. "God's hand was on my getting the message from Haman that the Jews will be killed, and God's hand was on your being appointed queen. Perhaps you were put into this position for this altogether unique hour in our history. Don't be silent. This is your greatest hour. Speak. Plead with the king. Stop this plot against our people." I've heard some people claim that they can't believe in the sovereignty of God because such a thing makes you passive. Frankly, I don't see it. Not if it stays balanced and biblically oriented. If anything, the sovereignty of God makes me active. It drives me before him as I plead, "Lord, involve me in the process, if it pleases you. Activate me in your action plan. I'm available. Speak through me. Use me." Certainly, we find no passivity in Esther. In response to Mordecai's request and admonition, she sends him this message. "Go, assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way. And thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish." Esther chapter 4, verse 16. What a courageous young woman. What training she must have received to respond like that. By the way, are you raising a daughter like that? Are you influencing her and teaching her in such a way that someday, when she faces the need for such a decision, she will say, if necessary, "If I have to perish, I perish"? I love the challenge woven into the lyrics of another grand hymn of the church. "Give of thy sons and daughters to bear the message glorious. Give of thy wealth to speed them on their way. Pour out thy soul for them in prayer victorious, and all thou spendest, Jesus will repay." Do you stand beside the bedside of your little girl and boy praying, "Lord, raise her up to be courageous, like Esther"? Cultivate in him the heart of a Mordecai. Speak your message through their lips. Carry out your great plan through the life of this precious child of mine. The plot thickens as the excitement builds. Esther plans a banquet for the king and Haman. Blinded by his own conceit, Haman thinks the queen wants to honor him. But when the king asks Esther what request she might have that he can grant, she says, "I want both of you to come to another banquet tomorrow. Then I will tell you what I want." Haman was thrilled. The queen was going to honor him twice with a feast in the presence of King Ahasuerus. "She must really think I'm something," he thought. On the way back home, he saw Mordecai, that Jew who would not give him the homage and deference he felt he had coming. Haman was infuriated at the sight of his nemesis. By the time he got home, however, he was once again puffed up with his own glory and recounted in detail to his wife and all his friends his banquet with the king and queen and his invitation for double honor the next day. Still, something stuck in his craw. "Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Esther chapter 5, verse 13. "Meaning? That Mordecai drives me nuts," Swindoll paraphrase. Then Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends said to him, "Have a gallows 50 cubits high," that's 75 feet high, "made in the morning, and ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet." And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Esther chapter 5, verse 14.